It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Heroin use in the Pittsburgh region has quintupled since the 1980s, and in 2014, over 300 people died from heroin overdoses in Allegheny County. Pennsylvania is near the top of all states for drug overdose deaths, with those deaths now surpassing those related to car accidents. A panel of experts has been brought together by City Councilwoman Natalia Rudiak, including Allegheny County Medical Examiner Carl Williams, to look at how to effectively address the region's heroin epidemic. He joins us now in studio. Dr. Williams, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul.
Just how bad is the heroin problem in Pittsburgh?
The heroin problem in Pittsburgh is very bad, but it's really one side of an overall drug problem that includes not only heroin, but heroin, cocaine, multiple drugs. So to focus just on heroin does not get us really to the core of the problem.
Heroin has been around for decades. Why is it so much of a problem now as opposed to in years past?
Well, the problem with heroin now is that it's spreading to every part of the community, old, young, white, black, urban, suburban. Part of the reason can be directly tied to the prescription drug problem in the United States. And we know that now. We know that as we try to control oxycodone, the worst offender in that, that the people that are addicted to oxycodone find that heroin is readily available and cheaper than their oxycodone. And that's been shown to happen. The other problem that's happening is that there are now sources not only of illegal heroin, but illegal fentanyl. And we're going to find in the next year that it's really not a heroin as much as a heroin and fentanyl problem. They're sold together. They're sold as heroin. If you remember a couple of months ago, there was a quote-unquote heroin overdose problem in the city of Pittsburgh. There were a total of 6 overdoses and 1 death. 5 of those were fentanyl. 5 of those were not heroin. So you don't know. And Allegheny County has its own crime lab, so I can look and see what's being sold into the community as well as what's killing the individual members. So if you look at our drug data, yes, if it is a single drug that is killing the person, in the last year it was likely to be heroin. But that's a minority of the cases. Cocaine comes after that. But we commonly see 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different drugs in our overdose cases. The actual overdoses just of heroin are 30-40% of the total.
And are there other factors in the community that have led to this problem becoming so widespread and, in fact, quintupling since the 1980s?
Our numbers are very similar to numbers in Philadelphia, Baltimore, Cleveland. Baltimore just reported 138% increase in heroin overdoses since the beginning of the year. So, yes, it's a severe problem. But I don't know, and that was one of the useful things I think came out of the meeting today. I think it's time to look and see what the sources of the problem are. Nobody can identify one specific reason that Pittsburgh, other than other communities in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, have such a severe problem.
How does this undermine the idea of a livable city, which Pittsburgh prides itself on?
Oh, I think it's tragic. I think, and I've started this just a couple of weeks ago, if you ask anybody, if you ask your gardener, if you ask your barber, if you ask your nurse, if they know somebody that has a drug problem, I virtually never get a no to that answer. So it is depleting of Pittsburgh of time, energy, money, and resources. It's a real dark wound on the city. And, it's a livable city, but we don't want it to be livable because of the presence of drugs. I think it's a problem that we all have to address.
What are the side effects of heroin? You talked earlier about how much less expensive heroin is than for someone to purchase than over-the-counter drugs or prescription drugs in this case. So obviously the problem is that with heroin, you've got some really negative side effects, don't you?
Well, the opiates, all of the opiates, oxycodone, fentanyl, heroin, all act on the central mechanisms in the brain that control heart and, in particular, breathing. So the reason people die from narcotic overdoses is that their breathing slows up. It slows up supply of oxygen to the entire body, and eventually they wind up dying of just respiratory problems. Now, that can be stopped. That can be stopped with antagonists. That's why the new naloxone availability, Prevention Point Pittsburgh, and through Dr. Karen Hacker allowing it to be prescribed, is saving lives in Allegheny County. And now with the more wide availability of that drug, that was part of the report today from the EMS, they're getting a lot of recoveries because now the antagonist is available to family members, available to people that are there when the overdose happens. So that should blunt somewhat the overdose deaths due to heroin. But the death is a respiratory death. Cocaine is a cardiac death.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking with Allegheny County Medical Examiner Carl Williams and looking at the region's heroin epidemic. How can we effectively and strategically address the heroin epidemic?
It's going to require a mass community effort, city, county, state. That was one of the things that was discussed at the meeting today. It's a social, biological, spiritual problem, and it's going to have to be addressed on all of those fronts. There is no easy solution to this problem. The drug prescription law that should be coming into act will start to regulate at least the prescription part of it, but this is an unregulated industry. This is lethal drugs being manufactured. We don't know where, possibly Mexico. In January, last January, when we had the overdose crisis and 21 people were killed regionally, that was a pure white powder that was half heroin and half fentanyl. Nobody had ever seen anything like that before. Where it came from, I don't know. I mean, obviously, it's a supply and demand problem. If we could take care of the demand for it with rehabilitation programs, with societal programs, that might take care of that. But you got to remember that the success rate in recovery programs, as good as they are, even with Gateway Rehab, the recovery rate is still less than 15%. The recurrence rate of addicted individuals is extraordinary. I wish I had a solution. My role as medical examiner, I was asked this question, my role as medical examiner is to make the data on this available to the public so that they can look at it, see what the problem is, so that people can begin to address the problem based on what's happening. So I stream my data regularly to a site called Overdose Free PA. You can go to that site and see as quickly as possible since 2008 what has been happening with the overdose crisis in Allegheny County.
And part of the problem as well, in addition to just trying to overcome an addiction, is the havoc that heroin wreaks on your body. And I'm guessing you can explain this pretty well. For example, regular heroin users experience hardening of the arteries that might not occur otherwise?
Oh, I don't know that they live long enough to experience hardening of the arteries. We see old junkies, but it's the sudden death. We don't even, and you'd have to ask again to the people that are treating the live addicts. It used to be that they would get problems because of the additives that caused reactions in the lungs. It used to be that they would get infections from dirty needles. It's one of the reasons that Prevention Point Pittsburgh, when their needle exchange is so important. Now it's death. I mean, now it's the worst case scenario. But I don't deal obviously with living patients. You should talk to the people at Gateway Rehab. They're the ones that are dealing with the living addicts are the one that would know what the crisis is. I see them in the. I've never looked to see if there's accelerated atherosclerosis because the median age is 20, 28, 30. Two peaks. There's a later peak at 45 to 50, and you'd expect atherosclerosis in that group anyway. So,
what are the disconnects between the facts about heroin and the myths, some of the things that might that people might assume about heroin that are not true.
Oh, if there are any myths, they'd have to be lingering myths from the jazz era of the 50s and 60s that somehow you can lead a productive life and be a heroin addict. That's not true anymore. They're starting the addictions in high school. They're mixing them now with the more powerful drugs, more powerful heroin, with fentanyl. I don't know that there are any happy myths about heroin, certainly coming out of the heroin community. If you talk to the recovering addicts, they didn't lead a happy life. They didn't leave any sort of a desirable life when they were addicts or any of the times that they were recovering. There was a recovered addict on the panel today, and they're more than anything else dedicated to trying to see if they can free the next generation from the scourges of it.
What other ideas have emerged from your discussions with city officials that can be used to fight this heroin epidemic going forward?
Resources, providing more resources. One of the things that they were talking about is halfway houses, registering, licensing, certifying, and examining halfway houses, because for some now it's just a way to make money. Rehabilitation services, resources to be poured into places like Gateway Rehab and the other rehabilitation programs in the Commonwealth. All of the possible approaches to provide resources for evaluation, treatment, and mental health. I mean, a lot of the addicts share, because of the addiction or before the addiction, mental health problems too. It's as I say, it's a biological, it's a physical, it's a spiritual problem in all dimensions. So hard to tell where to attack the beast.
Dr. Carl Williams is the Allegheny County Medical Examiner. He joined us in studio to discuss the region's heroin epidemic. Dr. Williams, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you very much for being here.
Coming up, a conversation with legendary recording artist Johnny Mathis, who's performing with the Pittsburgh Symphony.
No, I didn't want to sing mushy songs, but somehow that's what I ended up being famous for. And I got accustomed to relaxing and listening to myself, and I actually prefer those songs as far as my voice is concerned.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. If you could pick one voice to hear with a symphony orchestra, whose voice would you pick? There are a lot of different answers to that question, and there are a lot of people who would pick Johnny Mathis. And if that's your choice, you're in luck. The man known for hit songs like Chances Are, It's Not For Me to Say, Misty, and many others, and whose records have sold millions and millions of copies worldwide, is performing with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra on July 16th as part of the PSO's Thursday Icon Series. Johnny Mathis is a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award winner, among so many other honors, and he joins us now by phone from Hollywood. Johnny Mathis, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Well, thank you very much.
So how do you feel about coming to the Steel City and performing with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra?
I go back a long way with Pittsburgh, even when they had the Soot in the Air there. And then, of course, I've sung with the marvelous symphony so many times there. The hall is so beautiful, and I'm really, really looking forward to my return to Pittsburgh.
Right. It'll be taking place at Heinz Hall. And I understand that performing with a full symphony orchestra behind you is your preferred setting. Explain why that is.
Well, over the years, most of my recordings were done with the large orchestras, even though sometimes I did do occasional dates with smaller orchestras. But the ones that are memorable, probably because the songs that we chose to do were standard repertoire. In other words, songs that have been tested, proven to be iconic songs over the years. And I felt very comfortable singing those songs. A lot of times I have to sing music that is unfamiliar to me, and I have to learn it very quickly. And it's not as gratifying as it is to sing some of the great standard songs. That's usually what we do with the large orchestras.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but if my math is right, you are going to be 80 years old in September. Is that possible?
I can't believe it. Yeah, I'm always thought of as a little kid, you know, at least by the general public, because I started recording at such an early age. And yes, it is. It's a little bit devastating too.
Well, anybody who sees you swears you don't look anywhere near your age. And I'm curious what's keeping you out on the road and performing.
I wonder about that myself, other than the fact that my dad was my big hero. He was my best pal, and he's the reason that I started to sing. He sang very well and insisted at an early age that I get a voice teacher. So that was the basis of my foundation as a singer. I learned to sing, produce the tones properly when I was a little kid. So that gave me a little step up on longevity as far as my voice is concerned. I haven't had very much trouble once in a while, a little laryngitis, but other than that, I've been able to perform for all these years. I still get excited about each performance, because over the years my voice has changed a little bit, not drastically. I'm having to choose my songs a little bit more carefully, and therefore I get a wider range of songs that I can sing. I used to sing the same songs over and over and over again, and especially with the symphony, because I like to utilize as much of the orchestra as I can, and we have special songs with great big introductions and lovely interludes where I'm not singing. So that's what the audience looks forward to, I think.
When you say, Johnny, that your voice has changed, how has it changed?
I started studying when I was 12, voice lessons, and I sounded like a little girl, of course, as most young boys do. And eventually I came around and sort of had my own sound. I don't know. I finally got accustomed to hearing myself. For years, I didn't like what I heard because I did sound like a girl, I thought. So I've been able to maintain my voice over the years. So as far as my... I don't have any anxiety about singing in public like some of my friends who... mostly opera singers, they have to have the full range of their instrument, their vocal instrument, and they can't really perform a lot of the songs that they're accustomed to. But I've been very lucky; can't complain really.
Does part of what factors into your health, is it the fact that you are an athlete, and at one time you were a great athlete at San Francisco State? You set a high jump record and had to make a unique decision, accepting a recording contract or accepting an invitation to go to the Olympic trials and a chance to represent the United States at the 1956 Melbourne Olympics. How did you go about making that decision?
Well, I was accustomed to maintaining some sort of structure about whatever I did. As you mentioned, athletics was a big part of my life. But I was always accustomed to taking lessons, learning how to do this, learning how to do that. And as I mentioned early on, I started studying with a wonderful teacher who got me through my little voice changer moods. I finally got around to feeling very comfortable singing. As far as the athletics are concerned, I was just accustomed to working out all the time. So one day, maybe when I was about 30 years old, a long time ago, I met a guy on the golf course. He said that he was a kinesiologist, and asked him what that was. And he explained to me. And so I started working with him, exercising. It started 15 minutes a day. I thought, well, it couldn't hurt, but it's not really going to do me any good. But over the years, what it did is it got me accustomed to working out. So for the last 25 years or so, I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and go to my workout class. It lasts about an hour and 15 minutes. I do that 5 days a week, and I've just maintained it. It's just something that is a part of me now, and of course, it's really helped my not only my singing, but my physical look on stage.
Well, here I was worried that we were, you know, you're 3 hours behind us out on the West Coast. I was thinking, okay, we're getting this man out of bed, but that sounds like it's hardly the case.
No. I've been up quite a while.
Now, as far as the Olympic thing, do you ever think, hey, I could have won a gold medal and then gone back to being a singer? Has that ever occurred to you?
You know, I was so enamored with my buddies who were going. Bill Russell and Casey Jones were the big stars of the San Francisco Dons, University of San Francisco. I just wanted to go with them, and the only entree I had to the Olympics was through my high jumping. I decided to go to the trials that were being held at the University of California here in Berkeley. And the day before I was to go to the trials, I got a telegram, or at least my mom and my dad got a telegram from the president of Columbia Records in New York. We had sent them some tapes of myself singing with my voice teacher. And lo and behold, they said, we want you to come to New York and make your first recording. And that was the day before I was to go to the trials for the Olympics as a high jumper. So that didn't work out. But boy, I'm sure glad I went to New York and did that that interview. I had no idea what I wanted to sing or how I wanted to sing it. But I had some wonderful people there in the beginning of my career who put me on the right course and utilized the voice that I had without too many changes. It was kind of a smooth ride for a long time with my record company. And then, of course, I got to a point where I was able to sing what I really wanted to. And I recorded a lot of Christmas music, which became quite an iconic part of my career.
Yeah, the career didn't work out too badly, so you probably made the right decision. We're talking with Johnny Mathis. He is scheduled to be in Pittsburgh on July 16th as part of the PSO's Thursday Icons series. He'll perform with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra at Heinz Hall. Who were the performers who influenced you growing up?
I was influenced mostly by female singers because their voices were flexible. I always thought the guys, you know, got in a rut. They would sing one way and that was it. Because of my voice lessons, I guess, I maintain a lot of my flexibility vocally. So I was fascinated with people like Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan. My brothers and sisters, I come from a large family. I have 6 brothers and sisters, and my dad was a wonderful singer. And so they all had preferences about what music they listened to, and mostly it was jazz and rhythm and blues. Then eventually I got involved with a voice teacher who studied opera, and I studied opera with her for a short time. So I got a good, rounded sort of musical background.
You're best known for your ballads, and I read a quote from you that you never wanted to be a balladeer. Is that true?
No, I didn't want to sing mushy songs, but somehow that's what I ended up being famous for, things like Chances Are and 12th of November and Wonderful, Wonderful, Misty. And I got accustomed to relaxing and listening to myself. And I actually prefer those songs as far as my voice is concerned.
What did you want to do?
Oh, I wanted to be a jazzer. I hung out with people like Miles Davis in New York, and Oscar Peterson was my favorite musician of all time. So, I wanted to be a jazzer. But, of course, I was not a good musician. I wasn't good enough to sing jazz, really, because you had to improvise a lot on the chord changes. And I was just a singer. Very little knowledge about anything other than vocal pyrotechnics at a young age. The jazz stuff went out the window when I met Mitch Miller. He put his foot down, and he used to say, Mitch passed away recently, so I can say this about him because he won't hear it. He used to say some pretty stupid things about why he didn't want me to sing jazz because it didn't sell. I thought, well, who cares if it sells? You know, I'm a jazzer. But eventually, I think I was won over by my being able to sing the way I wanted to. And if the jazz influence came into my singing, then so be it. And that's kind of the way my style evolved.
You had your first number one hit, Chances Are, in 1957. This was several years before civil rights legislation and voting rights legislation. And here you are, a young artist who's taking the country by storm. What was it like for you as an African-American artist to be performing around the United States at a time when many hotels and restaurants and other places were still segregated?
That was kind of interesting. Most people didn't know what color I was because of the music that I sang and the quality of my voice. So most people weren't aware that I was a black singer. I got some of the shocks of my life when I left my comfort zone, New York, San Francisco, and went south to do some performances. Had to stay in a certain part of the city, even in Las Vegas when I started to work the casinos. I couldn't stay in the hotels. I thought it was funny. I just didn't understand the ignorance of it all. But I did it because that was what was happening. And of course, it only happened to me on a couple of occasions. And by the time I had gotten to a point where I was a headliner in some of the casinos, they allowed us to stay at the hotel. You know, being from San Francisco and traveling in the north as I had no idea. And I kind of thought it was funny, and then I kind of thought it was sad. But anyway, I think we've overcome most of that.
You scaled tremendous heights in a hurry. Was there ever a time when you worried about how you could sustain that kind of success?
You know, fortunately, there were a myriad of opportunities for music appreciation. Lots and lots of jazz clubs. A wonderful opera company, and lots of studios where popular musicians came through recording. So I had all these wonderful opportunities, and it really is the foundation of not only my music, but also probably my personality.
So you weren't too worried. It sounds like you were going to be happy with what, essentially, however it worked out.
And I was a little naive, which helped.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is Johnny Mathis. He's performing with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra on July 16th as part of the PSO's Thursday Icon Series. He'll be at Heinz Hall again on July 16th. I ask this next question, Johnny, because I think some of our listeners may take inspiration from it. I read that there was a time when you struggled with alcohol. What happened, and how did you overcome it?
I was very shy, always have been, very reticent, got very nervous going on stage at an early age. That was the biggest hurdle that I had to overcome. I drank too much champagne, of course, because I drank it whenever I performed. And I went to a wonderful little soiree with Nancy Reagan I sang at the White House on lots of occasions for her and her husband, the president, and she was there at these little gatherings. There were about five or six of us. Merv Griffin was there playing the piano, and I would sing. I happened to mention to Mrs. Reagan that I'd like to stop drinking because she said, "Why do you drink so much?" And I said, "Well, I'd love to stop, but I don't quite know how." So she got me, introduced me to Ron Reagan, who was on her staff at the White House. The next morning after she told me about Mr. Reagan and how he had gotten over his addiction, flew to New York, and drove down to Washington, and he drove me to a little place in Maryland, and I stayed there for 3 weeks and talked to the priests who were my counselors. Somehow it all clicked, and that's how I actually got over my addiction. And I recommend it to anybody who, if you think that you have a problem, you do. And I was so lucky that everybody treated it as they should have. It's a problem that needed to be addressed. We addressed it, and it absolutely saved my life and my career.
Next year, you'll celebrate your 60th anniversary as a recording artist. Looking back, what are you most proud of?
I'm most proud of overcoming my addiction to alcohol. There was no way that I could have continued. And as I mentioned, I think this is my 30th year of being sober. That, of course, was the biggest obstacle I had to overcome.
And now here you are, still going strong, still sounding good, looking good. Do you have any plans at all of retiring?
I was wondering about that. I said, well, when is it going to be over? A lot of my opera singers, of course, stop singing because they have to sing the whole song, all the high notes and the low notes and the ones in between. And I can choose the songs that, you know, that I don't have high notes or too many low notes or what have you. So, yeah, I'm going to be able to sing for as long as it sounds good. If it sounds good, you know, go ahead and do it. I have so many recordings, and I'm just perusing now some recordings that I did when I was 20 years old, 30 years old, 40 years old, and we're going to put them in a package and release them.
My guest has been the legendary Johnny Mathis, who is performing with the Pittsburgh Symphony at Heinz Hall July 16th as part of the Thursday Icon Series. Johnny Mathis, it's been an honor having you. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us and visit with us on Essential Pittsburgh. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. I'm looking forward to my performance with the symphony, and hope everybody comes and listens to all that pretty music that they make.
Thanks again, and take care, and safe travels.
Thank you.
Look at me. I'm as helpless as a kitten up a tree. And I feel like I'm clinging to a cloud I can't understand. I get misty just holding your hand. Walk my way, and a thousand violins begin.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This Sunday, a new exhibit will showcase in the main gallery at the Carnegie Library in Oakland. Sarah Creer leads the new project called Acceptance Journeys Pittsburgh. She's program director and research specialist with the HIV Prevention and Care Project in the Graduate School of Public Health at the University of Pittsburgh. In anticipation of the kickoff celebration Sunday, we met up with Sarah at the gallery and asked her a bit about her project.
Well, Acceptance Journeys Pittsburgh is a photo story project that aims to address LGBT or lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender stigma here in Pittsburgh. I work in the HIV Prevention and Care Project, and you know, we know how stigma and discrimination have been implicated in negative health outcomes in many groups, including people with disabilities, communities of color, and also lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. Stigma and discrimination, it creates conditions that allow violence against people who are stigmatized against, which leave people feeling isolated and afraid in their communities. Research shows that stigma and discrimination prevents people from accessing information, from seeking support, and also from seeking medical care. So this project was piloted in Milwaukee, and we learned about it through the community-based organization Diverse and Resilient, based there. We were trained by Gary Hollander, who piloted the project there. And we're basically trying to counter the negative health effects of stigma and discrimination by promoting acceptance. In addition, you know, this project is very much rooted and inspired by Project Silk, which is another project in the HIV Prevention and Care Project. And it serves young, Black, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender individuals here in Pittsburgh. We know that young, Black, LGBT people here in Pittsburgh are at increased risk for HIV, for violence victimization, for stress, for depression, and for drug and alcohol use and other health conditions. So this is a project, an intervention that really is trying to reduce the stigma that the people we serve through Project Silk face here in Pittsburgh.
Hanging on the gallery's walls are images of families, friends, teachers, and neighbors. Sarah told us all the participants were asked to choose somewhere they felt most comfortable telling their stories for the interview. So the settings range from living rooms to Mount Washington to the Gay and Lesbian Community Center in downtown.
Participation basically entails a photo shoot and then an interview where we basically ask people to share their stories of love and acceptance for an LGBT friend or family member. So we have stories from teachers about former students. We have stories from mothers about their sons, mothers about their daughters, sisters about their brothers. And so it's something that's very much evolved. We've been working on it for a couple years now. And the first phase was a lot of research trying to best understand how to start this conversation. So the goal is to really hopefully inspire conversation in the community, but also we hope that these stories can act as blueprints for people who might be struggling, maybe learning that their child is gay or a loved one or a family member is gay. So we're really trying to support people's processes.
Sarah's project looks at the experience of the LGBT community, but not in a typical way. She's not necessarily focusing on the LGBT individual, but the way that they're embraced by family, friends, and society, and what effect that's had on their journey.
Yeah, it's different. And I think it's been actually hard. Like, some people don't get the concept. You know, we're like, no, we actually, you know, we want the stories from the non-LGBT identified individuals, you know, about their love and acceptance. Even the name Acceptance Journeys, that was, you know, came out of Milwaukee, but it's really trying to document people's own journeys so that hopefully other people can relate to them and maybe hopefully see themselves in those stories.
Educator and writer Jamila Rice joins us in the gallery to talk about her participation in the project. She's a teacher and director of education at Urban Pathways Charter School. Jamila told us about her relationship with her former student, Aaron, a young gay man she's known for several years.
I knew Aaron ever since he was in sixth grade, but I didn't really get to really know Aaron until he was in 11th grade when I had him for English. And that's where we spent a lot of time together, not just in class, but outside of class on academic things, but then also just talking about things that we, interests that we had in common. I don't know exactly when he came out, but I know it was before I taught him. And I know that there were some students that I also taught at that time because I was teaching 11th and 12th grade, and he was in a lower grade, I think he was in 10th grade, who would kind of make comments, and I had to talk to them about the comments that they would be making. And there's their lack of understanding and just a lack of acceptance of anything that was different from them, what they thought was the quote-unquote norm. So I always make a point, no matter whether it's any type of discrimination or bias that students exhibit, to really question the source of where that's coming from and then provide them with alternate stories that they might not know of that maybe might challenge what their biases are. So not just that, but also about race and about socioeconomic status and all sorts of things that people have biases about.
Jamila said having Aaron at school made it easier for other students to feel more comfortable expressing themselves. She believes educators have a very significant role in changing attitudes and making sure students feel safe.
It's really so important, especially in schools, for teachers and other staff members to be educated themselves so they can learn how to combat any past biases that they had based on experiences or the way that they were raised, because those things come out, whether you use it in words, it comes out in actions. You know, it comes out in opportunities that you give to certain people but not to others, because you might think that they wouldn't be interested because of who they are and you think that that's different. Or it comes out in the things that you select to the materials in your curriculum that you decide to share with students and read with students. It comes out in the way that you discuss certain things that do come up within certain pieces of literature. How do you handle those kinds of conversations? Especially as educators, we really have a duty to make that space for all students to feel comfortable in order to learn, because learning is hard, you know, and being an adolescent is hard. And until we continue to be committed to extend ourselves to all of our students, then things are not going to get better.
Another participant, Tony McClendon, told us when she got a call from her longtime friend and drumming companion, Kelly, she didn't hesitate to respond.
She told me it was about, you know, LGBTQ people and people who love them. And I'm one of the people who love them.
Tony, Kelly, and their friend Latasha are depicted in Acceptance Journeys, talking about their relationship and the different perceptions they had of the LGBT community growing up. Tony told us she was always raised to be loving and welcoming toward everyone and places a heavy importance on storytelling and sharing experiences.
Raising your voices is very important. For one thing, in terms of telling your story, validates you. And to have someone else listen to your story and witness you as you tell your story is very validating and it's very healing, especially if they listen to you from the heart. We all have stories to tell. And so the more that we can tell stories to each other, the more we know about each other, accept each other, and have empathy for each other.
Community outreach is an essential element to Sarah's project. She wants to help remove negativity in the LGBT community, which often faces challenges right at home.
Families rejecting their children when they learn of them being gay. You might have noticed some of our billboards that we launched at the beginning of this year. Our first message was, "Whose life could you change with love?" And then our second message was, "We are family. I love my son no matter who he loves." The ways that stigma is internalized, especially in young people, relates to stress, depression in these communities. We are doing community discussions. That's actually being launched right now, where we engage the community in their understanding, their thoughts on this campaign. Asking questions, have you seen the billboards? What do you think about these stories? What do they say to you? So that's another element of our evaluation of this project.
If you'd like to see Acceptance Journeys Pittsburgh for yourself, they'll be holding a free kickoff celebration this Sunday, July 12th, from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. in the main gallery at the Carnegie Library in Oakland. A reminder, on Wednesday, July 15th, 90.5 WESA is holding a community forum on the impact of the Americans with Disabilities Act on our city. The ADA turns 25 this year. How far have we come and what remains to be done? As technology progresses, how should policy evolve? The forum will take place here at the Community Broadcast Center. It will be broadcast live on 90.5 WESA starting at 7 p.m. Doors open at 6:30. Space is limited, so please register now. To reserve your place, go to our website at wesa.fm. Next week, in addition to our community forum observing the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, Wednesday's Essential Pittsburgh at noon and 8 p.m. will also focus on the ADA. We'll look at design innovations being made to help people with disabilities and discover what life was like for individuals with disabilities before passage of the ADA.
Both in disability community, in disability studies, around the world, in the United States, narrative is a big thing for us. We tell our stories in part because our stories are not a part of the larger research. So first of all, you have to know what we've done and what we've experienced.
That's next Wednesday at noon and 8 p.m. on Essential Pittsburgh. Until Monday, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, everyone. This again.